You've been duly warned. You're being recorded even more than usual. All right. So our first person is Catherine. Are you here, Catherine?
I am. I just unmuted myself.
Great.
So I actually really loved the book. I initially struggled with it, one sentence, of sort of where am I, because I felt more at peace, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not in it. But then as I sort of let go of where am I in the stages, sort of like 10 ways, I found myself doing the same analytical and said, just read it, enjoy it, feel it. Then it came alive to me, and I sort of, I fell in love with it, and I fell in love with different parts once I let go of the analytical, where do I fit into the schema.
Okay, thank you. How about Diane Burke?
Hi.
Hi.
So she said something early on that sort of something I kept coming back to because I thought it was a wonderful invitation. And she said that when we feel vulnerable, as the fabric of who we are comes apart, that we can companion ourselves in the process by remembering that we're trying to contact something that is central to who we are and what our mission is in this lifetime. And I thought that was a very comforting invitation for all the ups and downs of both the journey and the book.
Well, so nice to hear your voice, Diane. I haven't talked to you in such a long time.
I know. It has been a long time. I'm glad to be here with the community.
Yes. Penny?
Yeah, James. Let's see. I enjoyed the book. I honestly am not through the whole thing. I found it... I really loved all of the little self-inquiry things that she had in there. I thought that was very helpful to reinforce what she was saying and to help bring it more, and make it more personal. That just really resonated for me a lot. And I did, like the earlier person said, you know, where am I? I kept saying, where am I? And have I done this? I'm certainly well into the middle age part that she's, the age part that she's talking about. And it's like, yeah, just let it be. And I enjoyed reading it from that perspective of not worrying about where I was and just seeing what was going to show up for me.
Yeah, I read the book figuring out where everybody else was, not me. We should read all assessment models and about not never about us. How about Yvette?
Yeah, James, I'm here.
Yes.
It was a pretty profound experience reading the book for me. It was the right book at the right time. 9 months ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and that journey has been quite an interesting journey. And the book talks about spirit door openings, and so there was a lot of connection with the book. I have to say, when I first started reading it, I was a little pissed off, actually, about her kind of referring her references to cancer. And then I felt like the middle chapters kind of dragged on. And when I got to the end, I realized that's how this journey has been. Like the down did drag on, and the bad parts did go on longer than I wanted them to. But then coming at the other end, I felt rewarded in some way because there was so many good gems and the love and the other parts of the book towards the end of the book as well. So it was a great experience reading it, and especially at this time.
How's your health?
Thank you for asking. Right now, I'm in remission, so that's a good thing.
Yes. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Kristen. No, Kristen. Sarah Cunningham is here, though.
Yes, I am. I loved this book. I felt my anxiety reducing as I was reading it. And there was a lot that I took out of it. I would say one point that she made that I really resonated with was the pitfalls of listening to your soul, which is when you have an insight and then you want to take it to the end, like, okay, I figured this thing out, and now how do I, like, actualize that into something? Because I have a terrible habit of doing that, and that sort of invitation to, like, just let something be there, I think was just really, really important for me. So I loved it.
Very good, thank you. Sumita.
Hi, I'm here.
Good.
Yes, so nice talking to you, James, after a long time.
Yes, it's been a long time.
Yeah. So this the book, I could relate the book at different stages, and I found it quite intimate and extremely interesting. In fact, some of the examples and case studies that she has talked about, I got so involved, and I was like, oh my God, this is like talking about me. And so it's the most interesting part for me was the juxtaposition of both the spiritual and the psychological growth pieces, and I felt as if somebody is holding my hand to realization of the different phases, and I'm still in a reflection mode. It's been rewarding, the book.
What time is it in Mumbai now?
So I'm calling from Mumbai. Yes, it's 5:30 a.m. in the morning.
5:30 a.m. in the morning, Wednesday.
Yeah.
Wednesday. You think it's Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Right?
Yes.
Very much, Melissa. No, Melissa. How about Celeste? No, Celeste. How about the other Diane Flaherty? No, Diane. Bruce is here, though.
Bruce is here. I was immediately drawn to the possibility of parallels between her cycle and the hero's journey. Monotype. I'm working with another group on that, and the question of to what extent Campbell's hero's journey reflects our journey through stages of development. And in doing that, I had come to the conclusion that it doesn't represent the stages as much as it does what happens between the stages. And that was very much what she was getting at here. It seemed the difference in what she was doing is that in the hero's journey, the hero can always and sometimes does refuse the call. And when I got into it, James, it seemed like she was casting it in a way that says, this call is pretty irrefusable. But then when I got to the part about opening the spirit door, I realized how many times I had refused the call. So I've been a little stuck with it ever since.
Well, we'll have to ask her about that. You could ask her. Maybe I'll remember too, but you certainly invited to ask her about it.
Okay.
Thank you, Bruce. Renee.
Yes, aloha. You know, this book, there was a couple of mixed feelings. I'll only talk about two of them right now. I think the one was the fundamental faith. And I think, you know, for me, as I get older, you know, I'm really, you know, honing in on my spirituality and kind of using that as my center focus of what I want to do. And I think the other piece of it that kind of pulled me in was unraveling, because in 2009 it seems like that's what my life was all about, unraveling, like the job that I love so much just didn't seem like the job I wanted to stay at anymore. And just, you know, understanding that that period was okay because we all transitioned through that. And now, okay, so what's next? How do we continue to experience those hidden blessings and continue our journey?
Thank you, Renee. Jeff. Are you here, Jeff? No, Jeff. How about Tina?
Hi. For me, what I really liked, the piece that I liked about this book was the compassion piece, because there really is no right, no wrong, no judgment, no excuses. It's a life's journey, and that was a good learning, because so often when we're going through it and or when we're watching or experiencing other people go through it, there those things come up, like why and the judgments and so forth. And this was really a book that helped let go of it and kind of allowed you to say, no, it's a process or a life journey that I have to go through or that the significant person that I'm with is going through. And so I really appreciated that from this book.
Thank you. Karen.
Yeah, thanks. Like some of the others on the call, I think I went through a whole range of emotions as I was reading this book. And I confess I have not got all the way through. And I think I've actually got through to the point that mirrors where I am or where I think I am in my midlife passage. I've really struggled to get beyond where I think I am. It's just an interesting place I find myself in. But I thought the book was, I thought the book itself was really interesting from a couple of different perspectives. One, as someone has already said, the self-inquiry, it really, that sort of drew me in. And again, started this whole debate of, you know, well, where am I in this? Or the, you know, what I've just gone through, having just come off a year of the PCC, you know, how much of that actually, how much of the changes that I saw over that one-year process actually comes from me being in the midlife passage. And then the other piece that perhaps gave me a way to continue with this, even when I was having some difficult feelings over the book, was I found the book to be potentially a really good resource for clients. And for individuals, I was thinking back to some of the clients I've had over the last 6 months and reflecting on, you know, where their ego was in the middle of the coaching topics that they were interested in. And you know, that's left me with some questions of curiosity, I guess, as I think about coaching individuals in the future that are in different parts of their own life stages, millennials, for example, or older clients, and what does that mean in terms of what I can draw from this book and what I can draw from my own experiences to help clients through that process.
Thank you, Karen. Georgia. No, Georgia. How about Kathy?
Unmuting. I'm here. I'm sorry. I was unmuting.
Oh, this is Georgia?
Yeah, this is Georgia. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
I love the book. I definitely interpret it as like a spiritual awakening causes a midlife crisis, and that's how I've seen it play out for me. But my favorite parts in it too were around also like the hidden blessing around depression, because I think that's intertwined in all of that, and it gives you kind of a chance to like look at it as like she gives you all the tools to help you walk through self-inquiry but I think this book is not like a book to read. It's like almost like a long-term study.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. Kathy. Kathy. Leah.
Thank you. First, I very much love the book too, as most people do, but I wanted to say I'm well past the midlife changes, and reading it from that perspective, I found it really kind of exciting, because it gave me a new frame to see all those past experiences, some of which, of course, were quite tough and hard, and some of which were, you know, growing, and I mean they were all growing in that sense, even the hard ones, but that were more exhilarating and exciting, and it just put things, it just gave me a new framework to put it all in and to remember. So I just had a lot of good experiences remembering, and I appreciate everybody's comments so far, because I kept wondering, what would it be like to read this when you're going through it, as opposed to being well past it and looking back. And one of the one more comment, and one of the things I just wanted to pass along was, when I was in that stage of the doors opening and not opening the way I wanted them to or whatever, I had a mentor that was a very wise mentor that said, sometimes the doors open in and you've been pushing and pushing on that door. You need to step back and pull it towards you. And that made all the difference at that moment in my life. So I just pass that along as a possible way to look at that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bob. No, Bob. Gail.
Hi. Yeah,
hi.
There's a lot I could say about this book. It was a deeply emotional experience for me. It ran along that beautiful dynamic bridge of psychology, spirituality, and I thought she held that tension just beautifully, masterfully. I was touched by the material. I appreciated the self-inquiry exercises, but even more I loved the experience of reading the book, which I could say more about later. But for me, I feel like I plowed through this midlife process over a decade ago, and I kept wishing that I'd had this book to read on my journey then. And then about halfway through, I made a little adjustment in how I was receiving it, taking it in. I started applying it to my current situation, where I'm again sort of coming to the end of the pier and several endings and transitions and going through a vocational crisis of sorts, and with a lot of the same questions and anxieties and reactive states and experiences that she described. So it was like I had a second reading of it, and I just, even though it's not a midlife crisis now, it feels like it was actually sort of helping me put things in perspective, you know, what I'm going through now. And yeah, so I loved it. I've already recommended it to 2 clients.
Thank you, Gail.
Rich.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I have for our friend Jed is this just one time through it, or do we have a chance to revisit?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a question that I had on my list too, James.
Yeah. Ruth.
Hi. Yesterday I ended up connecting with Jed just because I was trying to get on her, subscribe to her blog, and I heard from her, so we interacted a little bit. And she asked me to do an endorsement on Amazon. And as I found myself writing the word labyrinth, I thought, well, that doesn't seem right. And then as I started thinking about it, I realized that one of the things I was struggling with was in adequately receiving the book and finding my own sense of tension with it, is I couldn't really relate to all the stages, even though I would agree with several that I'm past so many of these. And I found that the labyrinth was able to help me see that I had gone through these in pieces and fragments, and I'm not sure I've completed any of them. And it just left me in a state of inquiry of, so where am I really? And interestingly enough, I related to the last chapters the most, and I thought that was kind of interesting. So I really loved the book. I loved the stories. I loved her metaphors. I loved her inquiries. And it was just overall, and I agree, James, that I would probably have to read this book 2 or 3 times to really feel like I've really got some sense of mastery over it.
Thank you. Victoria. I remember, I think I heard you come on earlier. Are you muted? No. Okay. No, Victoria. How about Sue?
Hello, James. It's nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. Hear you.
Well, I also love the book. I think what resonated for me is that I always enjoy books and concepts that relate to kind of a timelessness of life and the world, and things that refer back to other places and times, like her referral to Tibetan singing bowls. Mm-hmm. Or one of my favorite metaphors that she used in the book, not just a metaphor, was the idea of the spirit door originating from a Native American tradition of making a deliberate mistake that was put into kind of the fabric on purpose so that we could connect to a larger reality. And I could really, really relate to that. I do a type of weaving, a Japanese weaving, where mistakes are considered part of the beauty of the piece. And there's just something universal and timeless to me about the idea of making a mistake is only part of the truth. And pieces like that really resonated for me in this book.
Thank you, Sue. Our other Sarah Saratoni.
Hi, yeah. I'm appreciating everybody's comments here. And when I started reading the book, I thought I would do it as kind of like an academic exercise, like this has nothing to do with me, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized that, oh, my God, this has everything to do with me. And this is exactly what's happening in my life. And I read up to the end of the spirit door, and that was really helpful just to understand, like, what is happening right now. It feels like such a gift that I'm getting it right now. And then I found I struggled to move on past that, like another person's comment. Like, I know exactly where I am. I didn't struggle to find myself. I knew it was there. So I'm just really appreciating understanding what is meant by midlife crisis. And it's very different than what I had made it out to be. Like, I don't have any drive to buy a Corvette or, you know, whatever our cultural stories are around midlife crisis. So this has been a great experience, and it's very helpful. So that's it.
Thank you, Sarah. Virginia. No, Virginia. How about Sharon? Sharon. How about George? No, George.
Hey. James?
Okay. Yes?
This is Victoria.
Hi.
I finally called back in because I kept trying to get unmuted and it wouldn't work, and I just trying to say something.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you did.
Do you have time for me?
Yes, please.
Okay. So this is, like one of the other women mentioned, this is a book I'm going to study and read every line of, and it arrived at the exact right time. I had no problem knowing exactly what stage I was in, having been in stage 6 for quite a while, and there's no mistaking stage 6. And all the depression and stuff, whatever, it's all done for now. Let's hope we don't have to do it twice. So this was like, to me, blind Homer being led by Virgil, you know, through the dark woods. He's gotten in the dark woods, and now I can finally see some light, and it's just, it's one of the most amazing books I've read. I've already put lots of really good reviews. So being in the middle of it, you know, I think it really does make a difference when you're reading it, because you do not know where you are exactly. You know,
right.
I certainly didn't. So it's wonderful.
Yes, we don't know where we are. We don't even know that there is such a thing as being somewhere. We just think we have no sense of direction or no sense of orientation if we don't have a guide like this.
Well, and I thought one of her best signs was where she distinguished life crisis and, midlife crisis, because when our ego can repair it, because I did that for quite a long time at the beginning, quitting being in coaching training. Anyway, when your ego can pull you out, but now, I mean, in the middle of this, you can't. It just doesn't work.
No. Thank you, Victoria. Did I miss anyone? No. Okay. So we have half hour or so until Jed comes on, and I sent you out some questions. And the two that we can entertain or something else that you want to bring up are, what does the author say that explains, shows what you have gone through? People have been saying some general remarks about that. And then, what do you see as the hidden blessing in middle age? Jet makes her case for it, but do you really see it as a blessing, or is it just something to hold our nose and hold our breath and just get through? And so would someone like to speak to either one of those? What does the author say that explains, shows what you've gone through yourself? And what do you see as the hidden blessings?
You know, James, can you hear me?
Yes.
So, James, for me, the hidden blessing is more about self-awareness and wisdom. It's like those different stages you go through in your life is being able to appreciate it, knowing that it's okay, understanding that, you know, you're in a different place. But I think it's the beauty of it all is to be able to find what's that next step. Because even though you're there, you don't stay there, you don't die there, but you kind of utilize your wisdom to kind of move you forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Renee.
James, this is Yvette. I would say the hidden blessing for me that I could really relate to was coming out and feeling love. During my cancer journey, it wasn't all horrible. I mean, like 80% was, but there was this other 20% that was an explosion of love. I felt like I had these angels around me that were helping guide me through, you know, and that made me feel very loved. And people go their whole lives without really realizing how loved and precious that they are. So I could relate to that as she talked in the later chapters about, you know, following that bliss and feeling that love towards others and towards yourself. So that was really nice for me and helped to solidify some of the things I had been feeling.
Thank you. Were these angels people that you met or experiences that you had, or what do you, when you say angels, what do you mean?
There was so many people that reached out to me that I knew and some that I didn't know to support me through the process. And, you know, whether the angels were doctors or friends or family or neighbors or just kind coworkers, you know, there was just this army of angels. And I would envision that army of angels around me when I would go in for the chemo treatments or the surgeries that I had to go through. And they really helped me to get through that part of the journey. So I call them my army of angels, and I would visualize them and see them as great warriors in the room with me, whatever room I was in.
Wonderful, thank you.
Yeah.
Did you get the whole book read, or did you?
No, I read every word of the book.
Okay.
Everybody else, I'll probably go back and read it again. You know, I just found it fascinating, and I've earmarked it and highlighted it, and I really felt one of the passages, if I might, where it talks about towards the end, we need someone to meet us in the areas of our deepest vulnerabilities. We need someone to hold a space for us as we experience expansion in consciousness, and we need someone ahead of us on this journey to bear witness to and in affirm our unfolding process. That was a great definition for me of what I strive to do with the coaching.
Yep.
And so it was that, like, I wrote that out and I put it in front of me because that's the vision of where I where I'd like to, you know, take the coaching.
Thank you. I was asking about the whole book because at the end she says some pretty strong things about symptoms and what
yeah.
it means. And I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about that in your case. You may not want to.
You know, like I said in the beginning, you know, you go, well, I shouldn't say you, you know, I went through stages of anger and denial and loss and all of those things. You can imagine when somebody says the word cancer to you. And so at the beginning, I was a little bit put off by her wording, almost like we manifest these things in us. And it made me a little bit angry in the beginning when I was reading it, and that was okay. It's, you know, it was okay to be angry about it. And as I read more and more about it, I started to see her logic, and I do think, well, I don't feel I did anything to cause cancer on me or to come to me. Certainly taking that opportunity or that journey to understand what I can do to help my body and to help my mind and my spirit to go be able to go forward and evolve, I think is a valid point.
Mm-hmm.
But I did, James, have some mixed feelings about some of the language that she used. And
yeah.
I think because it was so personal and so relevant, you know, I had my last chemo two months ago now, so it's very, very current.
Yes. Thank you very much for that, opening your life to us like you just did. So someone else on either of these questions or something else?
This is Ruth, and it's hard for me to go after the last speaker because I don't have any personal connectivity with something so traumatic as going through cancer. So I'll try to be sensitive to that. My changes have been just lots and small life changes, but nothing traumatic. But the thing, I'm at one profile in the Enneagram, and I think one of the things that was the most profound for me so far that I can see is just learning to let go of the drama of acting out who I thought I was and learning to witness that in clients at a whole other level than I ever saw it before has been quite profound. And then learning to just relax into the realness without having to carry around any kind of dysfunction. It's like this weight that I've carried around, and I hear that from other people. And it just seems like midlife allows you to let that go, and you just don't need to hassle with it anymore. I'd be interested in what other people have observed about themselves in that respect.
Mm.
And then the latter part of it is opening to oneness. I first got connected with that about 15 years ago, and it just keeps coming up and coming up and coming up. It's not frequent. But I have these profound experiences of oneness and just love for everybody and everything. And it'll last for a while and, you know, it kind of dissipates. But it's had a profound impact on me and a real settling effect of not being in kind of an agitated state of some level. And so much of that's disappeared from just simply reading this book, not really doing any of the inquiries. I just tried to get through the reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only imagine actually working through this stuff, what difference that would make.
Thank you, Ruth.
James, this is Penny.
Yeah.
I really am interested in her answering the question about, is this really a one-time kind of linear path? I mean, she describes this linear path, and I'm not sure, in my experience anyway, I know I didn't follow that linear path, and I'm not sure how much I really recognized, as someone else said,
whether I was in these stages or not. I can kind of go back and see some of it now. And certainly someone else referenced the whole metaphor that she did fairly early in the book around the singing bowl metaphor about, you know, thinking about that bowl that we've spent our life filling it up with stuff, and part of this is to, you know, empty that bowl again. And I found that very much a metaphor that would have helped me, actually, when I was going through that kind of part of this midlife thing, you know, 20-some-odd years ago. And that entrance into the deep, dark place in the underworld, I think is the terminology that she used. Certainly that helped me see it from a different perspective. And even though I was okay going through it at one level when I went through it back then, just having a different frame on it now is like, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And the question that I have is this path really any different? You know, I'm in my early 60s now. Is this path that she's describing really any different for somebody that's in their 60s? And what is midlife now anyway? Is it still really 40, starting at 40? Or is it later in life, given the fact of the age that we all seem to be able to live to now? So those are some questions that came up for me as I was reading this.
Yeah.
And the hidden blessing for me is, you know, that it's like there's more opening up to myself and not really caring it, at one level. That sounds kind of coarse, but really not caring about what other people are thinking or seeing.
Yeah.
And how freeing that is, and how much more relaxing that is, and how much more I feel like I can be gentle on myself. But that's not all the time. I mean, I can't say that I've mastered that, so that is my way of being all the time. Anyway, that's just some of the thoughts that I had.
James?
Yes, let me just say something about what Penny said, and then whoever this is can speak. Near the end of the book, certainly in the last 10 pages, she says that she lays this out as if it's a linear progressive path, but of course, in real life, it's more complicated than that, and it's individual for each person.
Mm-hmm.
So
I didn't read the last 10 pages yet, so.
Yeah, right.
Hopefully.
Yes. Who was this? Who wanted to say something?
This is Victoria. I wanted to mention the hidden blessing. I've been working on bringing self-compassion to my life for a really long time, and it was very difficult. So this helped me see the golden parts I'd thrown away, in a way where I could have self-compassion that I had never gotten before. So that was the hidden blessing for me.
Yeah.
Just finally getting that it wasn't some crap about myself.
Yes.
Yeah. It was very wavy line, too. Very wavy, not straight at all.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you.
Yep. Welcome.
This is Leah. I wanted to also respond to the hidden blessing, or one of the hidden blessings, I think, of going through it. A few years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, one of the young folks that I worked with, we were just, I think, walking down the hall together, and she sighed a big sigh, and she said, does life get any easier as you get older? And I heard myself say, wherever it came from, say, no, but you learn to take it a little easier. And I think that's one of the things that I've carried with me after having gone through some of the things that I went through. Many of the things I went through was that I just learned to take it easier. It doesn't become, there's still things that happen that are, you know, you lose people through death and you have sicknesses and all kinds of things that happen, but you don't it doesn't hit you in the same way. It allows you have a bigger, maybe it's that bigger space that she talks about, that bigger matrix that you're working from. You have a bigger space to hold it in yourself. And so I think that's one of the hidden blessings, for, at least for me.
Thank you, Leah.
James, this is Bruce. Reflecting on what she said about sometimes it doesn't hit you till later, I couldn't, reading the book and thinking on my own situation, I was recalling a book called Grant Speaks. It's a fictional biography of Ulysses Grant from 15 or so years ago, and he was describing Grant being kicked out of the Army for drinking the first time around, and his commanding officer was to have explained to him that, "I'm not kicking you out because you drink. I'm kicking you out because drinking doesn't do you any good." And I thought of that as I was reading the piece about the open door and the idea that you can be confronted with an open door and it doesn't do you any good. You remember I had a life-changing accident 5 years ago, and I've been reflecting on whether that was the event or whether that was just one stage of a much bigger event. I was just sitting here looking at some files. I worked through that, got to a point where I thought I was recovered, and then was confronted with the fact that you're not going to recover. Life will be different going forward. And it was 6 months later that I applied to the PCC. So I'm thinking, you know, yeah, it's different for some of us. Some of us apparently don't get the message the first time around. I can imagine somebody out there saying, in case you didn't hear me the first time, let's try this again. So, you know, just how that onion unpeels, you know, is a big question I'm evaluating right now.
Thank you, Bruce. Well, I wanted to say something about the book and two things that we talk about these days in the PCC. So some of you, of course, have done the PCC a long time ago, and some of you were not in the class that I taught, so maybe your teacher didn't tell you this part, didn't say these two phrases to you, but there's two obstacles that I feel that we all have to deal with. They're kind of, they're in the category of meta-narratives or big socialized pitfalls we fall into. And the first one is image management. And in our book last month, those of you who were in the study group last month, we were reading the book An Everyone Culture, written by Leahy and Keegan, and is about organizations. And they say in that book, everybody who works in an organization has two jobs, whatever their title and job description is, and then their public relations campaign to make sure that everyone is seeing them in the right light. So I think that part of what can happen as a hidden blessing in middle age, and Penny, I think, talked about this, maybe some other people referenced it as well, is we stop having so much of our life swept up in image management. I know for some people it goes the opposite. So as we get older, we start getting very conscious about how we look, so we do surgery or injections or take hormones or go to the gym more or something. Because the idea that we are a human being who's aging and on the way to dying is too painful for us. But I think that one of the offerings of middle age is being able to ease up on image management and not be so concerned about it. The other is experiential avoidance, trying to make sure that we don't feel loss. We don't have things yanked from us. We don't have unpleasant experiences. We don't feel fear or embarrassment or shame or anger or jealousy or whatever the painful emotional event might be for us. We conduct our life and construct our personality to avoid those. And part of what I feel that Jet is saying in this book is that it will only take us so far, that sooner or later, all these experiences that we've been not wanting to have will arrive for us. So all of us on the call know, have had, know people who have died and had close people to us leave, either through death or estrangement or the ending of a relationship. We all know of or have had our own crisis of the body. We know people who have gotten very sick and have died, and some of us are, as Yvette was telling us, some of us on this call have had our own deep and serious illnesses. And besides that, events in the world happen. There's a big, it hasn't been that long, the world economy was teetering. Lots of people lost money, lots of people lost their chance to retire, lots of people lost their what they felt to be their security. And we're every moment having to deal with the degradation that we're making to our planet and the difficult political situation we're in, not only in the States, but in Asia and in Europe and in Africa and South America, all these places where democracy that once seemed to be a sure thing and the world was headed in that way, it's not so obvious anymore that that's occurring. There are many things that we can't avoid. And that's one of the blessings of Middle Ages. These events keep happening to break through our trying to keep experiences out. And as Bruce was just telling us, if the first few sorays don't get us, it gets more and more serious until we start to notice, aha, what I thought I could do with my life, what my life was for, maybe that isn't so true. Maybe it never was true, but it certainly doesn't seem to hold up anymore. And what happens? Who do I discover myself to be when I step away from experiential avoidance? So anyway, those are two of the blessings I see in midlife crisis, is the chance to step away from image management and experiential avoidance and find out who we are on a less, in a less distorted way, in a more direct way. So we still have a few minutes.
Yeah. Again? Is someone
still
here?
Yes, please. Yes.
Yes. I wanted to talk about the birth of the unified field and the integration of the upper world and the underworld. And so this chapter resonated strongly with me, and I was finding a relation between the unified field aspect and also the symptom. So on one hand, the blessing of midlife for me has been to work with the underworld and opening up of my own potential. Having said that, I also realize painfully that under stress, I sometimes go back to my upper world, because that is what has given comfort for many, many years. And that has been also my coping mechanism. So what has been really interesting for me is to recognize that when I do this, how this translates into symptoms, and it is so visible, it is so so palpable. And earlier, when you were talking about you know, the symptom work, it is even if the signs are there, even if the symptoms are there, it is so difficult to face it, confront it.
Yes.
So this is where I find myself right now, and you know, wanting to explore this further and deeper. And I think there's something very unique which can come through this.
Thank you. Did someone just come on and say something?
This is Jet.
I've heard of you.
Hello.
Hi, Jet.
Hi.
How are you today?
Hi, Jet. Hello. I'm good. Good. Thank you. Happy to be joining you all on this call.
Yes. So let me do a roll call so you can hear people's voices.
Thank you.
And get a little feel for who's here.
Great.
We're also recording this call that you can have, too, if you want it for whatever your use is.
Okay.
So some people who are in our book study group aren't on the call today, but they'll listen to it later.
Okay.
Okay, so how we can do this, everyone, especially for those of you for whom this is the first study group, I'll say your first name. If you could say your first name again and your last name and where in the world you are today, geographically, not where you are in the 12 stages. I told them, Jet, that you
Although
would
that might be useful.
Although that might be useful as well. That's true enough. Catherine.
Catherine D. Shepherd, Berkeley, California. Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Diane. Diane might be muted. So Diane Burke is in Albuquerque.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I was muted. Sorry.
It's all right.
Diane.
Penny.
Hi, this is Penny Carter, and I'm up in Bellingham, Washington, north of Seattle.
Hi.
Yvette.
Yvette Castagnon, and I'm in Morgan Hill, California.
Hello.
We have two people with this first name, so I have to say her last name as well. So this is Sarah Cunningham.
Hi, this is Sarah Cunningham, and I'm in Chicago.
Hi, thank you.
Sumita. She might be muted. She was just talking to us.
Okay.
Anyway, Sumita Datta is calling from Mumbai.
Oh, okay.
Where it's 6 o'clock in the morning on Friday.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Melissa. Oh, Moses, sorry. I'm reading names of people that aren't here. Bruce is here.
Bruce Fly. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Okay, Bruce Fly, Greenville in eastern North Carolina.
Hi, Bruce.
Someone else wanted to say? Okay.
No, it was Ruth Simone. I thought you said Ruth, and I heard it miss wrong. I heard it wrong.
Okay, not a problem. Renee.
Aloha, Renee Green, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Aloha.
Dina.
Hi, this is Dina House, and I'm in South San Francisco, California.
Okay.
Karen.
Hi, this is Karen Jones, and I'm in San Francisco.
All right, hello.
Hi.
But she's really from Manchester.
Okay, I hear that.
You can tell that.
Yeah.
Georgia. Georgia's here, and she's probably muted. She's in El Cerrito.
Okay.
Leah.
Leah Messner, Washington, D.C.
Okay, good old Washington.
Gail.
Hi, Jet. This is Gail Scott. I'm in Boulder, Colorado.
Hi.
Ruth.
Hi, Ruth Simone. Hi, Jet. I'm in San Mateo, California.
Welcome.
Victoria?
Victoria Smith, and I'm in Prescott, Arizona.
Okay, Victoria.
Sue?
Sue Strong, and hi, Jet.
Hi.
I'm in Morristown, New Jersey, and thank you for your book.
Oh, thank you. Morristown, New Jersey. I'm from Fort Lee.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Are these close by?
Pretty close.
Everything's
close in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And everything's a suburb of New York.
That's right.
Sarah.
That's me in Reno, Nevada.
Reno. Hello,
Sarah. And did I miss anyone? Okay. So I have a bunch of questions, Jet, but we're going to stop lots of times and ask what questions or comments or anything that people have.
Sure.
So one of the things I'm wondering, the question I always like to ask authors, but we'll see where it takes us, is what did you hope would happen from writing this book? And you can answer that in lots of dimensions if you want.
Well, I had such a difficult midlife and was caught so unawares and so ill-prepared that at first I just really wrote the book to survive. I just felt so spun out by it and blindsided and shocked and like I had been catapulted into a new world. And so writing became my path of putting one foot in front of another and tracing the inquiry those in the 90s they were very big. I think they're called stereograms, or the dots where they were 3D and sharks and other images would come into them.
Mm-hmm.
If you twisted your perspective, the callers recognize this?
Yes.
Twist your perspective,
yeah, totally.
And maybe you see a shark or maybe you don't. And in the 90s, there were people who fell in the category of those who could see the figures and those who couldn't. And writing the book really became me trying to see those figures, the deeper narrative under this very noisy story that was had become my life. And so initially I wrote with the hopes that I could survive whatever was happening and that this would be my lifetime. And then my client base shifted entirely into people with people who were going through the same passage. And so I began to, with their help, see that there was some universal something going on here. And with the help of Carl Jung's famous phrase that the instructions of the morning will prove miserable guides for the afternoon of one's life, I realized that I had to find a new set of instructions, a new way of being. And so it's been a very passionate, I really have just thought about midlife for 17 years, basically. And it's only now that I'm thinking about other things. So initially it was really for my own consciousness and to save my own life. And then I felt so moved by the people coming in, my clients, and who were suffering so terribly in a way that I was suffering as well. And then I created the online course, which was, the detailed program of what I had gone through and what I had discovered. And people kept saying, this is too much, this is too hard, but we still need help. And then I walked the Camino de Santiago, and on that trip, it's a 500-mile pilgrimage across the northern coast of Spain, on that trip, I suddenly realized how this could be brought into a book form, even though for years I said that's impossible. And I sat down and I just kind of wrote the whole thing out.
Oh,
and and I hope that the book will let people know that they're not alone. I hope it will contribute to this new body of literature coming forward about this very important life transition. I think it's the most rigorous, at least, that I've experienced in my adult life. And I hope that it will really save lives. I got an email just this morning, and this is not unusual, of people saying, you know, I was at the end of my rope. I stumbled across this material, either the form of the online course or the book, and I now know there's a context within which my suffering has meaning. And it's just very moving to me to save a life or to help someone save their own life. And so as you can hear, I'm passionate about it, and it's been a very moving journey for me. So that.
Thank you. Thank you. One thing I'm wondering about is what were you trusting as you went through all of this? And I think that's part of what is difficult for people, is we don't have a way of, as you just said, we don't have an understanding that of what's going on, and we just feel the chaos or the undoing or the spinning into who knows what, with no way of understanding that we can trust the unfoldment.
Yes.
So how did you find a place to stand or be with what was going on?
No, I think it's very important to lose trust over and over again, which keeps there's a process of losing faith, really, and regaining faith. I began to make a distinction, actually, between trust and faith. I began to see, for me, that trust was about trusting that something would be a certain way. And faith began to come into my consciousness. Faith is that something is some way, even though I don't understand it, and I have a faith that it's good and it's rooted in goodness, and that the more I can say yes and surrender and allow myself to be taken apart, reshaped, and refashioned, the more I experience the ground of being, and the deeper my faith in that ground becomes.
Do you have anything you can tell us, Jed, about how to cultivate such faith?
Yes, I think that the at least for me, I became aware of something that survived each blow. That there was, even though in the beginning it was a bare filament of energy, I noticed that with each blow and each unraveling and each shock and each confrontation with limitations, there was this bare flickering flame that alerted me in a way to a presence that wasn't actually drowning, wasn't actually losing consciousness entirely. And I think the process of losing consciousness and then feeling that very thin filament of energy or that flickering flame gave me a sense that there was something holding the process. There was something that I was immersed in that was larger than me, but present throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Another way that I have talked about this is that when we lose faith experientially and everything is lost, there actually is a moment, if we can catch it, of relaxation, of opening. The contraction gives way. And that, if one is inquiring into that, that becomes very curious. At the moment when all is lost, there is this relaxation and opening, and suddenly one has found a new place to be, even though it is the least likely place we would have looked for it.
Mm. Beautiful, thank you. Does someone have a question or a comment or something you want to bring to Jet?
And this is Ruth. I was just listening to this, and as I was listening to you, it occurred to me that that is the dying process, and that it's kind of a rehearsal, and we're dying to something better before we actually die, but we're actually learning how to die. Yeah. And that, I don't know, maybe I'm way off, but that was what I was hearing.
That's beautiful, Ruth. In a sense, the ego is our psychological birth, and in a sense, at midlife, there is definitely a death of the defensive structure of the ego. And so, I agree with you. That's why midlife is a rebirth within life. And I think it's William James who talks about the once born and the twice born. And he separates the world into these two categories. And I think he's speaking about that. People who he considers once born are people who actually never go through that death within life. And people who are twice born, they suffer through that death. And they are brought back to life in a new shape and form. And so I agree with you. And frankly, the model, if we use Kubler-Ross, that is what people are going through over and over again. They're fighting the limitation or the aging process or the diagnosis. They fight that. They get angry about it. They blame. They negotiate. They're scared throughout. They come to some form of peace. We're going through that with every single piece that is taken from us. So, and we have to go through that, at least initially, until that jagged sawtooth experience of having something taken from us or being taken apart becomes more and more undulating in its quality, because we've surrendered to the process. Thy will be done, not my will be done. And so so all that to say, yes, I totally agree with you. I also want to just mention that, you know, I can't remember which is in the Course and which is in the book, but I love that the Gospel According to Thomas. I love it where, you know, that phrase, seek and ye shall find, and that's repeated in several of the Gospels. But I love Thomas. I love Thomas anyway. But I love that he says, seek and ye shall find, and then you will become troubled. You know, he doesn't just say, seek and you shall find, and that's like the end of the story. He's
right.
Speaking about that undulating movement. Seek, you shall find, and you shall then become troubled. And then you shall reemerge in wonder. And then seek again, and you will find again, and then you'll become troubled again. He's speaking about that sine wave of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's our first psychologist.
I was amazed that you said, Jed, that you just sat down and wrote this, because you had so many references and quotes and so on in your book. Well, these are just things that you'd studied over the years that came to you at that moment? Or did you study as you were going along?
No, I was able to write that because I had just finished a course of 1,000 pages.
Right, right.
And
I
so
know,
the book is really is how to convey the major movements in a very abbreviated format. So I had already spent really 12 years writing the course. So
yeah.
The fact that the book just spilled out, it spills out on the heels of those 12 laborious years.
Yeah. And that included lots of things that you studied, or as well as studying your own experience and listening to your clients?
You know, so much of my work is really not from reading. It's from sitting with people. And I have become over the years very good at seeing those figures in that mess of dots. And so I am very disciplined about writing that down and trying to synthesize the patterns that I'm seeing showing up in my door and at my workshops and among my friends and colleagues. So I am basically a cartographer. I'm constantly looking for the map, constantly looking for the pattern, constantly looking for the thread.
My oh my. Let me ask one more, and then we'll see what other people want to ask.
Okay.
One of the difficulties of writing such a book as this and doing your course, although I haven't looked very much at your course, is the variations. Because, of course, naturally, as soon as you lay out 12 steps in this order, then there's all the variants in it. So what sort of variety have you found? And how much is there this strength of through line for people in the way you describe it?
Well, I lay out the 12 steps so people can actually have a cognitive framework. But the truth is that those steps can go forward, they can go backward, they can run in parallel, and they repeat over and over and over again. And so I find that in general, someone will land in one of the center steps for a period of time. The first step of shock, we're landing in every day. We turn on the news and we feel shocked.
Yeah.
And so we're constantly being confronted with something that we hadn't anticipated or is disturbing to us. We get stopped on the freeway by a highway patrol person. So shock is something that is constant and ongoing, and basically we, over time, move from the kind of shock that we resist to connecting shocks with shocks of awakening. And so that stage is something that we're really probably involved with every day and, or at least every week or every month to greater or lesser degrees. And after any shock, there is some slight unraveling, and then many people reconstitute if they can, and they go back to their normal high speed of life and functioning and everything else. And then as we move further in the journey, there are certain stages that can be very prolonged. The stage four, the time down under, and especially if it comes in the form of depression, that can be very protracted for people. It can also go up and down and come and go, but when someone enters that more depressed area, that's actually when most people think they've entered midlife. They actually miss the first three stages entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think they enter when they start hitting that avalanche of experiences that they feel they can't get traction under, they can't bring themselves back to life. And so that's when the stages actually become a little bit more protracted in length of time and intensity and force. But again, you know, we can go through bouts of depression at any time, and for some people it's a hum that runs throughout their entire journey. So there's a lot of movement in those stages, but if one gets the general feel of the stage, then even if it's just a, you know, three-day movement into a time down under passage or an emergence passage, we can kind of say, oh, yeah, like there's some movement toward emergence. So now there's a little birthing happening in my life and there's a little opening happening. Oh, you know, now I've slipped back into that underworld, underwater experience. And the goal is to not be attached to any one stage or any one experience. That's the quote-unquote goal. And when that happens, then the journey becomes more and more smooth and feels more and more like an unfolding, but they still have those qualities where you are circumnavigating yourself, you are feeling a new light, new sense of soul. And so in my experience at least, those stages continue to repeat well after midlife. In fact, most of the people who endorsed the book were in their 70s, saying either they wish they had read this when they in their 50s, or
right.
that it still is really actually a helpful way to help them kind of see how their transformation's unfolding.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the questions we had for you, whether they repeat or not.
Yep. I don't see them repeating into the 80s. I'm now working with a handful of clients again who are in their 80s, and there's definitely a new thing happening there.
Oh, do you want to say what you're seeing? Or we have to next book?
I don't really know what I'm seeing yet, but what I can say is that all the stages seem to flatten out into one. It's like like it's not, there are no more waves. There's just like, there's like a lake, and everything is in that lake, and it's the delineations cease to, at least in this group, small sampling, and also people who have done a lot of work on themselves, but you know, there's no more delineation.
My goodness.
So do you think, this is Penny, to build on that question of, do you think your sense of midlife, your 40 to 65, is expanded to be 40 to 80, or is it something that's a little bit different, 65 to 80, or what's your thinking now about that?
Well, you know, I have been saying that 45 to 65 for women is pretty clear that the 10-year, if, I mean, my midlife was 15 years, but the approximate 10 to 12 years unfold in that kind of span of time for women pretty clearly. For men, there are some men in my base who enter midlife at 40, so like ahead of most women. The preponderance of men enter midlife later than women. I've often thought that's because most men don't lose, they're not as compromised physically by andropause as women are by menopause. And I think that that's an important contributor to bringing us into midlife is kind of some physical destabilization. But what I do notice is people on the other side of midlife actually are different, whether they have achieved that difference through this kind of work or through some other means. There's a greater sense of acceptance for life as it is. There's a lot less preference and will to force life to be other than it is. They have laid down many of the egoic or been worn out by the egoic movement to achieve and accumulate and the rest of those enterprises that the ego is so good at. And so in that more relaxed state, they are simpler, often quieter, often less likely to move toward things that are overstimulating and filling up their holes. And so while I do think that midlife still happens in a 10 to 12 year period in that general span of time, this cycles repeat later, but they aren't that jagged sawtooth midlife experience. That then it becomes more of the, what I call the sine wave of transformation, where we're constantly going deeper and deeper into the soul's aims and into a more spacious, open, hopefully wiser place. Now, bear in mind, not everyone goes through midlife at all. Let's be really frank. There are people who haven't navigated childhood yet. There are people who are arrested in adolescence. So there are certainly people who don't go through midlife. And for them, aging is just a physical experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about some of the prominent people in our public world these days, and they don't seem to have gone through this.
I know. No, that's what's playing out on our world or political stage it's horrifying, shocking, and also also at least for me, if we're going to be specific about Donald Trump, for example, he's an example of someone who doesn't appear to have any inner conflict, which places him in the once-born category. For a person to be twice-born, in William James's vernacular, or to go through midlife and have that experience, there has to be conflict, suffering. There has to be a struggle. And he at least appears to be without that struggle, as do others in our government right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Jed, this is Sue. One of the things I wonder about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on, and James, maybe you as well, is any thoughts you have about, through the coaching lens, someone who has not perhaps gone through their own midlife journey, whether because they're not at the age of having gone through it or they just haven't, a la a Donald Trump kind of person, mm-hmm. and their ability to truly coach someone who is either on the journey or might be at a more advanced level of development. Mm-hmm. Because this scares me sometimes.
What scares you is that you have not gone through midlife, or
no. The idea of someone who has not gone through it, coaching someone who is either in the middle of the journey, or even has gone through it themselves. I wonder if you can really coach someone effectively if you haven't experienced certain things yourself.
Well, James, I'll start that and be happy to hear your thoughts as well.
Sure.
I was helping, quote unquote, people, guiding people through midlife before I went into midlife. And it's only looking back that I see, I was helping them in the kind of sequential way of a spiritual practitioner inquiring into what was happening, but I certainly did not have the context I have today. I think I was helpful to them and for them, and I trust that their coming to me and my sitting with them has some intelligence to it, and that I just kind of bow to that intelligence, mm-hmm. and trust that there was some good there. There was certainly good intention there and good efforts and the rest of that. And now, looking back, I think, oh my God, I didn't have a clue, and I didn't have a clue that when I landed there myself, I was completely caught by surprise. And so what I have decided for myself is that the experience of aging and gaining experience like this is an ever-humbling process. It constantly includes embarrassment and losing face. When I look back at myself 10 years ago, it's, oh, my God. And I suspect when I'm 71 in 10 years, it will be, oh, my God, about my experience right now. So if we have faith in kind of this evolutionary movement, and if we bring ourselves in a wholehearted way to it, I guess I sort of feel like there's an intelligence operating here, and good will come of that. I also, you know, so I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way, but there are certain things that now we know around midlife that, I mean, midlife really didn't exist in our grandparents' generations, right? The mortality, what was it, 47, I think, in the late 1800s, 47, that's right, 47. So, you know, there wasn't even this asset at that time in terms of lifespan to have a death and birth within life. Mm-hmm. So we're evolving, and, you know, in my mind, if the instruction and coaching isn't getting the client what the client is looking for, they'll move elsewhere. If they, because they don't have that good, that, you know, this kind of guidance, if they they may be forced to come to this information through their own efforts. I don't know. I would encourage people not to shy away from something, but also to know, to learn as much as you can, to feel into it as much as you're able to, and see what's in integrity for you with a particular client. Mm-hmm. And in my work, I also talk about that with the client. I talk to a woman who's talking about giving birth and saying that I have not actually had experience.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Beautiful answer. I would say a few things. One, I think it would be quite interesting and important for you, Sue, to study this fear and find out what it is. There's something there that it looks like it's about other people, but might not be, and who knows what it is.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's great.
The other thing is, I don't know about all the coaches in the world. I don't even know about all the coaches from New Ventures West, but I can say some things about the doorway into our class. We do our best. You don't know this whole process yet, but people send us applications and give us all this information about their life. And mostly what I'm looking for is the person's, this is, I'll say it so bluntly, has this person suffered enough to be open?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if they haven't, sorry, this class so won't work for you.
Yeah.
And it isn't by age, because there's some people that could be in their, well into their 50s and not that way, and there's some people that come to our class who are under 30, and yes, this has already happened for them. Their heart has been cracked open. So that's a big part of it. It's
thank you.
I just have to, I think, one more thing besides what all of what Jeff said.
And wait, James, before you go on, I actually am having trouble making out what you're saying. It's the line. Is there some way I can clear that, or?
I don't know.
It just became bad on this last question.
Yeah,
you're suddenly garbled.
A little underwater.
Suddenly garbled.
Well, I think you're probably diving to the depths, but you forgot to you're taking the phone underwater with you.
See, there's a new product line for you. Technology for the different stages of middle age.
And
this
I'm
phone
just
you can take with you to the depths. Let me try another phone here. Maybe this will work.
You're better now.
Does this change anything?
That's a little better.
Yes.
Does this change anything?
You're a little distant now, but not underwater.
Hello?
Ah, that's much better for me. How about
great.
Others?
Okay.
Good for me.
Yes, much better.
Okay. So what was I going to say? yeah. So it's so none of the coaching isn't a matter of what we know. It's a matter of our willingness to explore something as it arises with as much willingness to learn and be affected by it and changed by it, to let go of our pre-existing notions, to meet the person as much as we can in the moment where they are, and to know ourselves well enough to understand when we are not letting go to enter into the client's world, but trying to pull them into our world where we are more comfortable and more familiar. So I think that's the main awareness is, am I letting go and expanding, or am I contracting and trying to pull the person to where I am?
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So I have a question. This is Catherine here.
Catherine.
Yeah.
And we just touched on it a little bit, James. You said in terms of what you look for when you're reading people's PCC applications. But I was wondering, you know, there's this broad age span, but yet you say 40. So how, I guess, the play between it being event-triggered, human development-triggered, so in terms of, like someone who's been through the PCC at a young age, let's say mid-20s,
yeah.
they're doing a lot of this work already.
Yeah.
And then how much of it is age-related, like our bodies for women going through hormonal stuff, you know, beginning to have joint funkiness, no longer being able to run in the way one once did. Mm-hmm. So that the interplay for different people, and I can speak actually for myself, like, I was trying to figure out, well, when did I go into this? When did I start? And I had a really painful experience in my late 30s that I thought, well, maybe was that it? And actually the event itself, losing my best friend, I didn't. I coped with that completely ego-based. I was superwoman. Mm-hmm. It was the aftermath of the effect on my marriage and on my sense of self and my identity when Superwoman no longer worked. Mm-hmm. But that was still late 30s. But mm-hmm. then that, I think, went into my 40s. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's this interplay of age. Like it's like Piaget, you know, if you look at Piaget in stages, they're very much, you cannot put a child into pre-operational thinking. It's just where the child is.
Right.
That's my wondering.
Yeah, I mean, in my view, people in, for the most part, generally speaking, people in their 20s and 30s and even into their early 40s perhaps, again, very generally speaking, their task is to really develop an egoic structure capable of fulfilling the obligations of the social contract. So they have a particular job to do. And I have worked with a young man in his late 20s who was dying, who mm-hmm. did go through these stages, because he had forfeited that social contract because he wasn't going to live to fulfill it. And so he had an accelerated experience thrusting him into these stages of attempting to be twice born, I guess. But in general, there is an important prerequisite to ego deconstruction, which is ego construction and ego strength.
the ego has to be strong enough to enter the process of disassembling itself.
Okay.
Now, I've worked also with people who don't have sufficient ego strength in their middle adult years, and they signaled to me, and I knew from experience, not to, well, they were not going into this process. So they need to conserve their ego strength until whatever due date is on whatever their transformation is. They need to conserve their ego strength in order to function in the world, and they will not go through this kind of deep dismantling process that we're talking about today. But there are always exceptions. Always exceptions.
Thank
you. By the way, I keep wanting to say to you, ask you, Jed, if you know about Richard Rohr.
Oh, yes.
But he's having, do you get his daily meditations?
I don't.
It's worth it.
Oh, okay.
It's it takes 2 or 3 minutes to read, and it's a deep visit into mystical Catholicism, or mystical Christianity, better said.
Mm.
What had me think about it is he's doing several weeks about the cross.
Oh.
And about Jesus' death.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making the point that you're making, which is that the cycle of life everywhere is death has to preclude transformation.
Yes.
And that the symbol of the cross, even though most Christians don't know that, that's what it's reminding us of, that there's no suffering that's pointless.
Right.
It opens up something.
That's right.
So he's,
well, it opens up the door to the mystery, really.
Yes.
At the point of intersection of the vertical and horizontal.
Yes.
And the cross was originally the tree of life. You know, it kind of got morphed into the cross.
The Christians were so good about taking everything over.
Yeah. So the Catholic Church, Christians,
right.
Certainly. The esoteric Christians are very similar to the Taoists and all the other esoteric streams, but
they are
esoteric for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Mrs. Ruth, I just wanted to thank you for bringing that up, because I've been a follower of Richard Rohr for a long time, and I was hesitant to bring up his name, even though I was struggling with this connection, so I'm so grateful for that.
Mm. Oh, you're welcome, of course. One of the parts of the book, Jet, where I thought you were the toughest, at least for me, of course, was when you're talking about symptoms and diseases.
Mm.
Because the example that you used in the book was somebody getting Alzheimer's.
Yes.
As a symptom of their soul calling out for something.
Yes.
So can you say some more about that? Because that seemed like a particularly fierce example, because this is why it seemed fierce to me. So if I somehow catch on that Alzheimer's is happening for me, and I even have this insight about what it's a deeper symptom of, or what my soul is wanting or needing, or what I've neglected, but I really can't do anything about it because my brain is going.
Yeah. Well, speaking personally again, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 65, and 67 was the diagnosis, 65 was with the onset, and within a year really didn't recognize her family members, and then was 12 years in that process. So I consider Alzheimer's to be a deep study in my world.
Okay.
And I went through various passages where I would try to, my father always tried to bring her here. He had signs around and remind her, and I thought, well, why not follow her where she's going? And so for years I would attempt to follow her energetically, intuitively, psychically into wherever she was instead of insisting that she come back here. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it felt like that if I traveled much further, I might not find my own way back. And so I began retreating from that process I was in. And in the course of that, I realized that things are not as they appear. I know this doesn't sound like a brilliant insight, but it was at the time for me that I had no idea after a certain point of imagination where she was and what she was actually engaged in. And I had always felt that with the absence of the brain, how would one track and know and inquire? And I perhaps too felt the vulnerability of that. But then I realized that, you know, what a wonderful challenge to identify consciousness without the usual means that we might access that consciousness. And so I do feel like one part of Alzheimer's is an attempt to be in consciousness our consciousness to be able to be located in a place that we currently can't perceive with the vehicle we're currently in, including the brain.
Okay.
I mean, just a quick example is a friend of mine was losing her hearing at 50, and I was talking to someone and said, you know, I was just in great distress about this. She's actually my best friend, and it was very painful to watch her go through this. And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, she's been hearing for 50 years. Why not do something different? And I thought, okay. You know, there's a big yes there, isn't there?
Wow.
And so, you know, the chances of my contracting Alzheimer's are very high. I have the polymorphism, gene mutation, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, my uncle. I have a very high, you know, possibility of that. And I don't literalize that. I don't reify that. I just recognize that from one perspective, a Western perspective, I have a very high, my odds are higher than the general population of having that experience. So I use it to open, to surrender, to accept, to wonder, to inquire, and to see what life wants to do with me. And whatever it chooses to do with me, I do believe at this point I will say yes. Midlife has really gotten me to the thy will be done, not my will be done.
Really, I can tell.
Just sealed the deal on that for me.
Wow. What I so appreciate about what you just said, Jet, was it showed me how narrow my band of what it's okay if this happens, and it's not okay if that happens.
Yeah.
So I was okay, of course, I know about sickness, old age, and death. That's
right.
All going to happen. But these other things, like dementia in the middle,
right,
or losing hearing, just to pick those two examples.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow that's not included in life, or somehow that's makes life impossible.
Right.
Rather than understanding that, of course, life can show up in all these ways and has always showed up in all these ways and will continue to show up in all these ways, whether or not I understand it or like it or it's my preference or anything.
Exactly.
There it is.
Yeah.
Can you, you make a wonderfully strong point about the importance of silence, and I don't know at what stage in the 12th that you start talking about how important silence is, but can you say why it's so essential?
I actually talk, I mean, I mentioned that, I think, throughout, because there's just so little support in our culture for silence.
Yeah.
I think I make the distinction between quiet and silence. Silence is the deep field within which everything exists. And, you know, the Buddhists talk about emptiness. I'm forgetting, there's a term that the shamanic culture uses. But since I come strongly from the Christian tradition, the recognition that the capacity to hear God or the divine or life itself in its most exquisite and subtle timbre can only be accessed if everything is quieted down. And so developing a practice where we are not interrupted and we can be quiet and open and listening, you know, just seems to me one of those non-negotiables. If I'm working with a person and they can't carve out some time, I don't require meditation, but I do require that they carve out some time for silence every day. It's, I think, the only requirement I have.
Thank you.
It also creates kind of a little bit of a riptide in this tremendous force of egoic movement.
Yes. Well, I have one more question, and we'll see what other people have. You may have already answered this in the amazing things you just said about surrender. I was going to ask you about the balancing between effort and surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a balance between the two, or is that just an egoic way of talking about it? Is surrender the heart of what you're talking about?
Well, you know, definitely in the early stages of being beaten.
Does that keep fading in and out for anyone else?
Am I fading in and out?
I experienced it, yes.
Okay, I'll try to speak up, and please cue me if that's still happening.
Thank you.
I also have another phone I could switch to. But, you know, I think there is a place for effort, like in Mary Oliver's poem, West Wind 2, she says, pull the oars from the water, sit and be still. And then later on in the poem, she says, when you hear the roar of the falls, when you can taste the mist on your lips, then row, row for your life toward them. There is a place to join with the movement, and sometimes that requires effort. But I think it's very important that we, like you said earlier, James, we know ourselves well enough to know when that effort is being expended toward the aims of an ego versus in service to the soul. And so I think there is a place where the experience is one of efforting, but if it is in service of the soul, then the soul and life includes hearing loss and includes efforting.
Thank you. Someone else have something you want to say to Jet or a question?
This is Leah, and I wanted to, when you were talking about the following your mom with the Alzheimer's and so forth in this whole discussion that was very moving between both of you, James and Jet. I wanted to mention a book, which is, I think it was written in the, I don't know, it was written quite some time ago, maybe 7-8 years ago. It's called Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, and it's a fiction book, but it's really quite a interesting journey into a woman who is basically moving into dementia. And I just think it broadened my experience or my sense. I lost my moving, trying to move away from the idea of dementia and being more open and accepting to where that could take us if we go there, or those are people who are going there. So I just recommend that book as a really good one to read.
Yeah, thank you so much.
What?
I love her work.
I'm sorry, James.
Elliot, tell us the title again, please.
Oh, sure. Woman on the Edge of Time, and the author is Marge, M-A-R-G-E, Piercy, P-I-E-R-C-Y.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Well, we just have a few minutes, so I wanted to ask you, I had it written in my notes three different ways. What's next for you? What's now for you? Or what's up for you?
I don't know what's next. What's now is, I've been in a somatic symptom exploration.
Right.
Life is moving through me with various health challenges, and thus far, I'm happy to report that I noticed that yes, I was talking about earlier, seems very, very strong. And so I keep expecting myself to crumble into some kind of anxiety or worry pattern, but I just notice that I'm not. The faith I have in life and its unfolding and the way it unfolds through me seems to be very strong right now, and I am very grateful. And I had hoped to walk the Camino again, and I just realized that I am walking the Camino in a different way.
Mm.
And so I'm on pilgrimage, and I am, I won't say I'm totally enjoying the journey, but I'm open to the journey as it's unfolding.
Mm. How is your book being received?
I'm really getting some beautiful letters, like I was mentioning. Of course, there's my base and my following who are just lovely, and their outpouring of expression and love and support. But I am getting a lot of letters from people that I am just delighted that somehow they did a Google search and found it. And so it's been really really lovely. And I had tremendous support from you, the professional community, other authors. I mean, people, the outpouring of support has been just really beautiful.
Mm. Well, I think many of us on the call are recommending this book to lots of folks. I don't know how many people I've recommended it to so far. Pretty much anybody who walks in my house gets to hear about this book. It doesn't matter how old they are.
I appreciate that.
Well, it's also, you're welcome, but it's also, you are, one of the things I say to people is you found a way of saying very difficult things to people in a way that they can receive it.
Mm.
And that's very difficult to do in a book.
Mm.
But you found a wonderful voice that can open people. So thank you for hanging in there for all those years so that you could bring this gift to us.
Thank you. And thank you so much, James, for the work that you're doing, and everybody on this call. This is difficult work.
I can't imagine doing anything else, but it's it asks so much of us, and it gives so much back.
Mm. Thank you, everybody. Good night to Jet. Good night to everybody. Good morning to our friend in India, and we'll talk next time.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Good morning.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.